From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from the dirt roads of the Depression-era South to a Manhattan cabaret, we talk with singer Betty Johnson. When she was a girl, her family sang its way out of poverty with their gospel group, the Johnson Family Singers. As a young woman, Johnson sang jazz standards in top nightclubs and TV variety shows. She stopped performing to raise a family. Now she's back with a new CD. Also, Apple Computer recently decided to allow other computer manufacturers to clone the Macintosh. We talk with Stephen Levy about this and other developments in the computer industry. He's a computer columnist for Newsweek and the author of A History of the Macintosh. And commentator Gerald Early compares the black and white middle class. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Reserve has hiked interest rates today at the end of a two-day meeting of bank policymakers. NPR's John Itzty reports.
The Fed raised its federal funds rate and its discount rate by half a percentage point. Many economists think this will be the last hike in rates for several months as the Fed pauses to watch the economy closely for signs it's slowing down. But the Federal Reserve's statement today gave no indication of whether this will be the last rate hike for a while. In its statement, Fed policymakers said that despite tentative signs of moderating growth, today's action is necessary to keep inflation contained. It's the seventh rate hike by the Fed in the past 12 months. It's likely to raise interest rates for borrowers from credit card users to small businesses to holders of variable rate mortgages. Critics say the Fed has overreacted and is slowing growth despite little evidence of increasing inflation. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
Meanwhile, the banks, rather the nation's biggest lending banks, are boosting their prime lending rates. Norwest Bank was the first to increase its discount rate half a point to 9%. Chase Manhattan, Citibank, First Chicago, and Bank One have quickly followed. More increases are expected. A federal study released today says at least a third of the nation's public schools are structurally unsafe. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The General Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress, spent almost 8 months surveying 10,000 schools throughout the country. A third reported extensive plumbing and roofing problems, old faulty wiring, defective boilers, clogged sprinklers, unworkable windows, and fire escapes. Yet as many as 13 million students and teachers spend 6 hours a day working in these conditions. To repair or replace many of these facilities, federal investigators say it will cost about $112 billion. Another huge expense, according to the GAO survey, is asbestos removal, an $11 billion expense. State and local school officials are unlikely to come up with that kind of money, as is Congress. Senator Carol Mosley Braun, Democrat of Illinois, who requested the GAO survey, is asking for $100 million to deal with some of the worst problems. But there's no guarantee that it will survive the wave of cost-cutting in Congress these days. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
NASA says the launch of the space shuttle Discovery has been delayed by at least a day. Engineers are blaming a faulty navigation unit. The shuttle was supposed to blast off just before 1 tomorrow morning Eastern Time. The new liftoff time is set for just after midnight Friday morning Eastern Time. Discovery is supposed to rendezvous with the Russian Mir space station in the middle of its 8-day mission. The government says its main economic forecasting gauge has chalked up a smaller-than-expected showing. The index of leading economic indicators rose 0.1% in December. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is just up a little more than a point at 3,845. This is NPR. The House of Representatives is expected to vote this afternoon on a bill on unfunded mandates. The legislation prevents Congress from imposing new regulations on states and local communities without giving them money to pay for it. The Senate has approved a similar measure. House Republicans are using their majority status to block nearly every Democratic attempt to weaken the bill. GOP leaders expect many Democrats will join them in passing the legislation. If it's approved, it would be the second item from the Republicans' Contract with America to pass in the House. Last week, the House approved a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. The Senate is now debating it. UN relief agencies are asking for more than $20 million in aid for refugees from the war in Chechnya. The relief groups are also waiting for permission from Moscow to start working in the war-torn republic. Cindy Shiner reports from Geneva.
Five UN agencies said they needed just under $24 million to help some 160,000 civilians who have fled rebel Chechnya to neighboring republics since fighting erupted in early December. The money will go to provide food, medicine, and other assistance through April for those displaced from Chechnya. An additional 260,000 people have fled to the south of the republic, but UN agencies have been denied access by the Russian government. Authorities in Moscow, however, have permitted non-UN relief groups to operate in Chechnya. Relief sources here said they had been nudging United Nations officials for the past 2 weeks to put pressure on Russian authorities to approve further UN humanitarian assistance. The UN has to wait for an invitation to enter Chechnya because it's domestic conflict. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Geneva.
Immigration authorities say arrests of illegal immigrants are way up in Arizona. Some authorities believe it's tied to the fall of the Mexican peso. More than 18,000 illegal aliens were arrested in Nogales, Arizona in January. That's double the number from a year ago. One immigration attorney says more people are trying to move north to flee growing poverty. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I was recently introduced to the singing of Betty Johnson. Although she's a new voice to me, you may remember her from an earlier part of her career when she was a regular on The Jack Parr Show and a headliner at such nightclubs as the Copacabana, the Persian Room, and the Sands. Some of our listeners may remember her from a time deeper into the past when she sang gospel music with her parents and three brothers in a group called the Johnson Family Singers. The North Carolina family sang their way out of poverty, eventually touring the South with stars of the Grand Ole Opry and singing on network radio. Betty Johnson retired from singing to raise her family. Now she's returned to the New York cabaret scene and to recording. She's released 2 CDs on her own label, Johnson Gray. The Take 5 sessions features recordings from the 50s. Her new work is on her CD, Betty Johnson, A Family Affair.
Baubles, bangles, see how they jing, jing-a-ling-a. Baubles, bangles, bright shiny beads. Sparkles, spangles, my heart will sing, sing-a-ling-a. Wearing baubles, bright shiny beads. I'll glitter and gleam so. Make somebody dream so that someday he may buy me a ring, ring-a-ling-a. I'm told that's where it leads. Sparkles, spangles, my heart will sing.
Betty Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
I'm really intrigued by this recording of Baubles, Bangles, and Beads. I think it's perhaps my favorite recording of the song. I'm not sure. I don't think I usually hear it as a ballad. It's usually done more of an up-tempo or a rhythm song.
That's true. Baubles and Bangles and Beads is very meaningful to me when I first came to New York and actually was learning to sing popular songs because I had not been singing those with my family for a long time. I met Chet Forrest and Bob Wright.
The authors of the song.
The authors of the song. And I remember very well saying, oh, I'm going to learn to sing popular songs and I'm going to have an act and I'm going to do all these things. And we went to a very tiny club in downtown, I think in the 30s. And about six people were in the audience. Both Bob and Chet were made up the six. And I was going to sing Baubles and Bangles and Beads. Well, I was extremely nervous, naturally. My first time in a dark room. I've always been in a studio. And I started singing Baubles and Bangles and Beads. And I said, Baubles. And then I thought, I don't remember what I'm supposed to do next. And then I said, bangles, hear how they jing, jing-a-ling-a. And then I got more, became encouraged that I really had a voice and it was coming out. And I did it, and after the show, and of course after the song, the six people, including the authors, really loved it. And they said, oh, that's just wonderful. What a wonderful interpretation. And, of course, it was just my nerves. And so I kept it in. And now I'm not so nervous when I sing it.
I'd like to go back to your early days when you were singing with your family.
Right.
How did your parents decide to form the Johnson Family Singers?
Well, it's interesting. It's amazing what an empty stomach will do. We were very, very poor people. We lived on a farm. We lived on anybody's farm who would hire six hands. And we were, as little as we were all workers. And it was a very tough life. We didn't know that it was tough because we were a family. We were happy. We had our own cow. We had our own chickens. And we ate well, but we did labor. We were manual laborers. And my dad, we'd come home and we'd sit around on a little braided rug, I remember, in front of the fireplace, and we'd start singing. And we just all had a wonderful talent of singing. So Daddy said, well, you know, I'm going to go to a school. I'm going to go and learn music, and I'm going to teach music. And you're all going to sing, and one day we're going to be a real famous singing family. And we all thought, oh, Daddy's wonderful, but how is this going to happen? Well, on Sunday afternoon, we would all sit on our porch, which was a log cabin, and we announced to different people, you know, the word got around the communities that we were going to sing. And people would come and actually sit on blankets and listen to us sing. And Dad just said, we're going to do it. And he had tremendous vision. I can't believe that it all happened. It's such an unbelievable story that most people just don't believe it. That's all.
So did he go to music school?
He went to the Stamps Baxter School of Music in Dallas, Texas. It took a whole year's of earnings of our family to do that. And he was only gone for 4 weeks. And he came back and he had a chart, a music chart, I shall never forget it, a big size like a map, and it had the clefs, and it had the shape notes on it, and he taught us to read that. And we just had that talent.
Well, let's get a sense of what the Johnson Family Singers sounded like. This is one of their recordings.
He put the sunshine in my soul.
You first went on the road, I think it was during the Depression, and your father made a trailer that you
yes.
could travel in. And I haven't seen any descriptions of that trailer, but I just find it hard to fathom that your father would actually make a trailer.
It was like a house trailer, and we bought lumber, we built a chassis, and we left our home in this trailer with a car pulling it, of course, with one envelope that had been given to us by our minister saying, if you ever need money, there is money in this envelope. And my dad said, no, faith is going to get us there, and faith will bring us home. And we would stop. We'd run out of gas, get low on gas. We'd stop at a service station. And my dad say, now, you know, we're a family. We're going to a music school in Cookeville, Tennessee. And we haven't any money, but we have a talent. We will sing for you. You can take up money. You can whatever you want to do. And everybody would say yes.
What would you sing?
Oh, we would sing hymns mostly. And people were just, they loved us. And they saw to it that we got. And by the way, we didn't just sing to exclusive white audiences either. We sang in many, many, many black churches. and wherever, I don't know, you've got to have an awful lot of spunk to do what my dad did.
How would your father get you into black churches? How did he get the people in the black churches interested in your music?
Well,
I should mention here, the times were very segregated, obviously, too.
Well, it was very segregated then, of course. It was, I can't tell you how terrible it was. But my dad as a young man had sung, would you believe, in a black, all-black quartet. My dad was a pretty, I can't understand. I know he worked in the mill, and he met some people, some men in the mill that he liked, and they sang. They did barbershop quartet, and they did spirituals. And actually, that's when my dad met my mother. My dad was singing in a black quartet. Now, you couldn't go in a white church with three black men and one white man, but the black people took Daddy into church.
How did your family end up singing on the radio? I know, I think you sang on radio stations throughout the South.
No, we sang on a 50,000-watt CBS outlet. And the that was...
That'll get you around.
That got us around. But how that happened, there was a big convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. And it was a contest. And whoever won this contest was to have a shot at a radio program, one guest appearance. My family sang at this contest, and we won. And instead of having just one guest appearance, we were signed for a forever contract. And we started singing a 6:15 a.m. show call. It was a hymn time show every morning. And we drove in from the farm. That was a 45-minute drive. Then we got an afternoon program sponsored by the same sponsor for 16 years at 5:35. Now, that was a new experience because we had always sung hymns and spirituals and gospel songs. But a man came down from New York by the name of Larry Walker who played the piano, and he thought that we were talented and that we could learn to sing all kinds of songs. So on that program, we learned to sing popular songs, American songs, Western songs. So we did that program, and then we did a Carolina Calling. That was a network program. Then we were sponsored by Quaker Oats for a lot of years. So we just worked all the time and went to school and worked the farm still. But by that time, we bought our own little place, and that was pretty special.
My guest is singer Betty Johnson. She has a new CD called Betty Johnson, A Family Affair. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer Betty Johnson. After the family stopped singing together, you went out on your own.
That's right.
And you won the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scouts
right.
contest. So what opportunities did that open up for you?
That opened up an opportunity of singing. The one thing I could take, the one thing I could do was the Copacabana, which was then a very famous nightclub, and I became the production singer there. And then I got another guest shot on a CBS radio program called The Galen Drake Show, which was a Saturday morning program, and I made the most money I ever made in my life. I made $150 a week. So I was able to move out of the YW and find an apartment down in Greenwich Village. And then I started really pounding the streets and trying to find work. And I walked into a big advertising agency, and I said, I want to meet the top of this agency. Can you believe this? And I met Nat Wolf of Y&R, and he was intrigued that I had the nerve to want to meet him. I had written a letter first. And he was a little intrigued. He said, "Now, what do you think you can do?" And I said, "I think I can sell." I said, "I want to sell ice cream or milk or toothpaste." And I smiled, and he said, "Well, you have nice teeth." He said, "What would you do if I gave you a glass of milk and told you that it was a Borden milk?" And I said, I took the glass, and I took a sip, and I said, "That's the best tasting milk this side of Possum Walk Road." He said, "Where's Possum Walk Road?" I said, "That's where I come from in North Carolina. That's our farm." Would you believe, Terry, that I got a commercial that lasted for many, many years?
There was a 1958 Billboard review of one of your club acts, and it described you as the girl we all took to the prom. Her good-natured charm, her Wellesley looks, and onstage poise. And I thought, Wellesley looks?
Right.
She grew up in a log cabin. So I bet you felt when you were singing that nobody really knew who you were.
No one ever knew who I was. And I've always felt that nobody's really terribly interested in who you are. They are interested in your entertainment. After all, people are coming to hear you sing. And I would always look the part. Even on the Jack Parr show, I could never talk. He knew me, and he wanted me to talk, but I was unable to talk. And now you can't stop me. You have to be 65. You have to be 65 and know you don't have that many more years to talk, I guess.
I want to play another recording of yours, and you recently reissued recordings that you made, I believe, on the radio.
Yes.
From it's the Take 5 sessions of the Marine Corps. Was this a radio broadcast for the Marine Corps?
Yes, and it was for the troops, and it was all over the world, and I did it for 4 years.
Oh. And what years
and,
were
and
we talking
I loved
about?
It. I loved it because it was my daytime work, and I got to sing all the songs I wanted to sing. 1957, 58, 59, 60.
Let's hear your recording of that old feeling.
I saw you last night and got that old feeling. When you came inside, I got that old feeling. The moment that you danced by, I felt a thrill. And when you caught my eye, my heart stood still. Once again, I seemed to feel that old yearning, and I knew the spark of love was still burning. There'll be no new romance for me. It's foolish to start, for that old feeling is still in my heart.
That's Betty Johnson, recorded in the mid or late 1950s.
Right.
You left singing and retired to raise your family.
Yes.
Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I had not had a successful... I'd always had a successful career, but I had not had a successful personal life. I was married to my manager of a year. I was divorced. I had been married at 19... I have a beautiful son of that marriage. And I met a wonderful man. I was singing at the Coconut Grove in California, and I met a wonderful person. And I thought, I'm going to have a life after this. I'm not even 30 yet, and I've had two divorces. And what's going on? I'm doing something wrong. So I thought, I have to give up what I love the most. And what do I love the most? I love singing. I love entertaining. I won't tell him this, but I will give this up and devote myself as much as I have to my career. I will devote myself to a husband and hopefully to a family. And I did it. It's the most painful thing I've ever done. And The good news is it paid off. I have a marvelous family. I am very, very proud of my family and of my husband of 35 years.
Well, did he encourage you to give up the thing you love most?
He really didn't know. He didn't know that I was giving it up for the reasons I gave it up. I just said to him, "Oh, I've worked all my life. I don't want to work anymore." You know how a woman will do that. But he certainly has encouraged me to sing now.
What was it like for you during the years when you were raising your children and not singing? Did you sing at home?
No, I never sang at home. I listened to public radio. I listened to classical music all the time. I learned classical music. I went back and got a degree at Dartmouth. I raised a family. I spent time with them. I did everything mothers do. And I loved it. And I'm a gardener, and I'm a master flower show judge. I studied for that. That didn't take me far away from home. So, no, I didn't think about it.
So when did you decide the time was right for you to start singing again?
It took a series of illnesses, major dramatic illnesses.
Yours?
Mine. I had a death experience. I had...
You mean a near-death experience?
Well, yeah, I came back. And then I had a very serious, scary operation on the throat, growth on the vocal cord. I thought after that, God is telling me something. I'm supposed to use this voice that I now have again. And so I just decided to do it. And I called a wonderful piano player, Tony Monti, and I said, I knew he'd be honest with me. Musicians are very honest. They will let you know. And I said, do you think I can do it? And he said, when do we start? So I started rehearsing with him and lost my voice totally. And I thought, well, maybe I'm not supposed to. Then I went away again and came back and I said, no, I'm going to really try it. And if the people love it, I will do it. And I got an engagement. That was my first engagement with Algonquin. And people did love it. And I realized how much I missed it. How much you can give the greatest dinner party in the world, but people do not stand up afterwards and applaud. They just don't do that. They just say, thank you very much. So that was pretty exciting to me. And now I feel that I'm a minister of music, and I'm putting it out there.
Betty Johnson, her new CDs, The Take Five Sessions and A Family Affair, are available only through mail order at 1-800-838-6110. In June, Johnson will perform at the Oak Room of the Algonquin in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Time after time, I tell myself that I'm so lucky to be loving you, so lucky to be the one you rush to see in the evening when the day is through. I only the passing years will show. You've kept my love so young, so new. And time after time, you'll hear me say,
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Apple Computer recently announced that it will allow other companies to clone its Macintosh. What will that mean for consumers and the computer industry? Coming up, we talk about this and other developments with Stephen Levy, computer columnist for Newsweek and the author of A History of the Macintosh. Since the last election, there's been a lot of talk about the disaffected middle class. Commentator Gerald Early says there are several middle classes. He considers what it means to be black and middle class. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The House of Representatives has passed a bill curbing Congress's ability to impose unfunded mandates on states and local governments. The legislation forces Congress to help pay for any new regulations imposed on state and local governments worth more than $50 million. A similar bill has already passed the Senate. It's one of the items in the Republicans' contract with America. The Federal Reserve has raised short-term interest rates again. It's the seventh increase within a year's time. The central bank is trying to ward off inflation and slow down the rapid growth of the economy. The discount rate is now 5.25%. The move has led to an immediate increase in the prime lending rate of several banks. This makes borrowing more expensive for millions of Americans. Major League Baseball talks have resumed in Washington. Team owners and players haven't met face-to-face since negotiations broke down in December. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
For the first time in this 5.5-month-old strike, players and owners are meeting with the knowledge that President Clinton is ready to step in if there's not a quick resolution. The president has set a deadline of next Monday for the parties to either reach a settlement or show significant progress. If they don't do either, mediator Bill Ussery has the power to come up with his own proposal. Before today's meeting began, Ussery said he hopes the two sides can work it out themselves. The owners are presenting a proposal they call comprehensive, one that includes non-salary and non-benefit issues. They say it represents a serious effort to get negotiations off dead center. But if the players perceive the plan as another attempt at limiting their salaries, dead center is where these negotiations might stay. In Washington, I'm Tom Goldman reporting.
The first Cuban refugees leaving Panama have arrived in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The Panamanian government says it wants the rest of the refugees out by March 6th. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
With loudspeakers blaring salsa music and amid heavy security, the first contingent of Cuban refugees were flown back to the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The operation, codenamed Safe Passage, will involve more than 4,500 American GIs to guard the refugees and to head off any possible disturbances. According to Major General George Crocker, the Cuban migrants will be treated with respect and dignity. Panamanian human rights organizations have strongly criticized the operation since the refugees have demanded a right to travel to the U.S. and are being sent back to Cuba against their will. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed slightly higher today despite the Federal Reserve's decision to raise interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points to end the day at 3,847.56. Advances led to declines by a 4-3 margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. An Australian state is moving toward legalizing euthanasia. The Northern Territory is planning changes to laws governing assisted suicide. Trent O'Keefe reports.
The Chief Minister of the Northern Territory, Marshall Perrin, has come back early from holidays to announce he's to introduce a bill to Parliament legalizing euthanasia for those who fit the profile. Under the proposal, which many believe will pass through Parliament to become law, those wanting to end their lives must be mentally competent, aged over 18, and diagnosed to die within 12 months. The Chief Minister, whose mother died of cancer after a lengthy illness, says it's not carte blanche on the ill, but will allow for a dignified exit. Opponents of the plan, including Rita Marker of the US-based International Anti-Euthanasia Task Force, say such a law would see humans becoming disposable objects. Many interstate and federal politicians have refused to comment. For National Public Radio, this is Trent O'Keefe in the Northern Territory, Australia.
Emergency workers in the Netherlands are working frantically to shore up dikes against rising floodwaters. Soldiers have joined the effort. Newly reinforced dikes are holding back two major rivers. The Netherlands is deluged with the same heavy rain that flooded parts of Germany, France, and Belgium last week. The rain combined with early melting alpine snows and made bad flooding problems worse. Up to 250,000 people have been evacuated from low-lying areas in the southeastern Netherlands. A senior aide to Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry says the mayor is going to declare an economic state of emergency. This gives the mayor unprecedented unilateral power to rein in the mushrooming budget deficit without consulting the city council. Washington, D.C. faces a fiscal crisis. One estimate puts the deficit as high as $750 million. It's not clear what Barry will do, but some recommendations call for 10-day furloughs, laying off of workers, and limiting Medicaid and school spending. I'm Corva Coleman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Apple Computer has decided to make a move that it's always resisted. It's going to allow other manufacturers to clone the Macintosh. That is, it will allow other manufacturers to duplicate the Mac operating system. My guest Stephen Levy is a computer columnist for Newsweek and the author of a book about the history of the Macintosh called Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, the Computer That Changed Everything. He says the decision to clone may change the computer that changed everything. He told me why Apple decided to license clones.
For years, Apple has been urged by various commentators to license their operating system, which is the software that really makes the Macintosh a Macintosh, the easy-to-use way to copy files and get to files and to, get the software, no matter what the application is, to work in a very easy-to-use fashion. And finally, they've decided to do this because they're very worried that their market share is small and getting smaller. They only have between 10 and 15% of computer users using Macintoshes. So they feel by allowing clones, by letting other people license their operating system and put it on other brands of computers, they can increase their market share.
Now, what will this mean for consumers in the short run?
Well, in the short run, it might mean, if Apple finds the right partners, that they can buy the Macintosh technology, which has traditionally been a little more expensive than other kinds of computers. Actually, years ago, it was much more expensive. And so you'll be able to buy a Power Mac for probably 50% less than you could buy one now.
Why had Apple decided not to allow clones until now?
Well, the operating system, the software that makes the Macintosh, was the crown jewels of Apple. If you let other companies come out with computers that use that operating system, what would make Apple special? Why would people buy an Apple when they could buy a lower-cost computer that operates exactly the same?
So why change its mind now?
Because they're very scared that this market share, the small market share, is not going to grow. And they're particularly worried that the people who write software, who write applications like word processing or spreadsheets and other things you could do with a computer, will say, well, why even bother to write for Apple? Why write in the Macintosh operating system? Because 90% of people don't use it. So they have to keep the best software authors interested in their operating system.
Well, so few people are buying Apples now. Apple is afraid that there won't be new innovative software because the market's so small.
Exactly. I think that there are ways around this. I don't think you necessarily have to license your operating system to bring in the best people. You know, when Macintosh first started, there was, of course, zero people using the Macintosh. They had to build a user community from scratch. And what they did was they really went out and wooed developers. They had this program called the Evangelism Program. And it was like a religion. They went out and they brought the machines to people and they pampered them and they did everything so people could get excited about the Macintosh and realize it could be good for their business to start with something which was brand new and very exciting and could do different things, could be more powerful. And I think they have to kind of get back to those roots and concentrate more on evangelism and getting people excited about writing for their machine to develop new things you can do with the Macintoshes. And maybe that's the way to bring in these third-party software authors.
So in the short run, at least, for consumers, this decision means that there will be cheaper copies of
the Macintosh technology that's available. Do you think there's a downside to the decision to allow clones?
I definitely do. You know, right now, I think a lot of people who buy new Macintoshes are people who are upgrading their old Macintoshes. And these are people who would buy Apple technology anyway. So faced with that, if I have the option of buying a Power Mac for $2,000 from Apple and the same machine for maybe $1,200 from someone else, obviously I'm not going to give my business to Apple. Likewise, there's another problem in that if other companies are making Macintosh-style computers, they might add their own features, and sooner or later, you're going to have computers that don't operate exactly the same. And that makes it more difficult to develop new operating systems that are really innovative because, you know, all of a sudden they say, well, gee, what about this brand X Macintosh? We have to write our new software so it works not only on the computers that we make, but those other computers, which are really part of our families. So it makes it more complicated to do new innovative things and takes longer to do it. So Apple finds itself in a tougher situation to beat Microsoft, which is really their competition in operating systems, to beat them with innovation, which has really been their strong point to date.
My guest is Stephen Levy, computer columnist for Newsweek. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with computer columnist Stephen Levy. You wrote a history of the Macintosh computer, and in that book, which has just been published in paperback, you write, very few tools transform their culture. Macintosh has been one of them. How did the Mac transform the culture?
Well, I think before the Mac, people understood that computers were important and understood that they were going to help us somehow access information and create things, using that information. But there was no real comfortable way to do it. The arcane commands you had to use, typing codes into the computer to get anything done, really put you at a distance between yourself and your information. And Macintosh really embodied the first way to get at that information in a very comfortable way, as easily as access information by sitting at a desktop and physically interacting with it. And that idea had been out there before, but no one had really got it out to the public in a very amiable, easy to grasp manner. And that style of using information, that style of using a metaphor within the computer that related to the way you operate when you're not using a computer, is, I think, going to be the single way that people are going to, process and change and create with huge masses of information in the future. So I think that even though the Macintosh system itself one day might slip into history, the idea behind it is going to be everywhere. And we'll use, that idea to communicate not only with computers, but telephones and refrigerators and television sets.
Now, your book reminded me about the image computers used to have back in the 60s and the 70s, when computers meant large corporations storing data about you, or it meant the phone company processing your phone bill that said, do not fold, spindle, or mutilate on it. It was this whole sense of, like, anonymity. You're just a name in this big computer. And then we started getting computers of our own. Computers took on a completely different meaning.
Right. It's been kind of a Pac-Man maneuver. The computers, once we saw as these objects that depersonalized us and were used against us, suddenly fell into our hands, and we could, switch things around and have an incredible amount of leverage against these large institutions. I guess the best example about that, though it's not necessarily a very positive one, is of the lone computer hacker sitting in his bedroom with a low-cost computer, bringing huge institutions to their knees. It just gives an indication of the power one person with one of these devices can have. And, of course, there's a lot more benevolent kinds of applications, like allowing you to, for instance, to publish a newsletter or a small magazine, using a very small outlay in capital.
You got your first Macintosh demonstration in 1983. And what you saw really surprised you. What were some of the things that you saw?
Well, the first thing I was impressed by was the fact that, like a piece of paper, the background of a Macintosh was, you know, was white. It was a light color, and you had dark writing. The letters and the drawings were dark on that. And, you know, of course, I grew up using pieces of paper, and, you know, I typed with pieces of paper. And that was something that was very comfortable and very accessible. And I'd always felt at a distance using my previous computer, which had those green phosphorescent letters that if you stared at for a long time, it was like looking at one of those eight balls you turn upside down and the letters would mistily come into view. And the second amazing thing was when the person demonstrating it to me had me type something into it, and we selected the type, and with one little click of the mouse, moved the type from, you know, regular looking type to an italic font. And that somehow just struck me as something marvelous had happened, because, you know, being a writer, I knew that, you know, previously the process it took to get, you know, the regular looking letters I'd write, the normal font, into an italic font, you know, meant that you'd have to use a very expensive linotype machines and stuff you couldn't do in your own home. And all of a sudden I realized, with this machine, we're all publishers, we're all typesetters. And there's a huge range of things that we're going to be able to do now that we couldn't do before. So it isn't just, you know, making our lives easier, it's enabling us to do things that previously only professionals can do.
What was the research like in deciding how the point and click system would work and how many buttons there should be on the mouse and how many clicks it should have to make?
Yeah, one interesting thing I did in Insanely Great was try to document how the things you see when you use a computer don't just happen there. They're really the result of a lot of arguments and sometimes user testing, sometimes, you know, one very vociferous, smart person within a group arguing for, you know, a certain alternative. So I used an example of the amount of times that when you go to a word on the top of the screen, something called a menu bar, and you select an option, be it cut or, you know, spell check or, you know, paste or something, it blinks on the screen, gives you a little feedback to let you know you've selected it. Well, how many times will you blink the thing? Turned out to be a big question in the Macintosh team. And they had a huge argument about it before they finally decided on three times it's going to blink. You might have used the Macintosh for 10 years and never even noticed how many times it blinked. But they were so passionate about it that the people who lost the argument got a concession that users would be able to go to the control panel part of the operating system and adjust it. If they felt that three was, you know, too many or too little, they could have it blink twice or four times.
Let me ask you a keyboard question. I've often heard that the reason computers have the kind of keyboards that they have is that they assumed everybody was used to using a typewriter and it would be too hard to break the typewriter habit. But were it not for typewriters, the whole way of using a computer would be completely different. How much truth is there behind that?
Well, certainly, you know, they're based on typewriters because that's the way people get text into things. And we're really stuck with, a keyboard for the near-term future because, you know, voice recognition, which would be another reasonable way to get, you know, words into a computer, is somewhat far away. You know, pointing devices like the mouse give us other ways to get things into the computer. You know, one thing which is very frustrating, to people who think about these things is that we're stuck with the keyboard layout, which was left over from the typewriter days.
Right.
And, you know, the layout now, if you look into the history of the typewriter, is actually designed to slow down your fingers so you don't jam the keys of a typewriter. And, you know, it would make sense for people to learn a better layout, a keyboard layout, like the Dvorak system is one that's known to, because you don't obviously have that limitation in speed when you're using a computer. You know, you should be encouraged to let your fingers go as fast as they can because the computer can keep up with you. But, you know, because this means that of using a keyboard layout, the standard is so ingrained, no one's had any success in convincing people to use a different one.
You know, there are restaurants now that are computerized where the waiter or waitress uses their finger on the screen instead of a mouse or a tracking ball. Is that the wave of the future?
Well, I think the wave of the future is everything you could imagine that computer technology could be used, it will be used. At one point, you know, that example you used would have been quite startling. Now it's, you know, an oh sure situation. And I think that, you know, as computers get even less expensive, get easier to use, people are going to find zillions of oh sure applications to integrate these things into their lives. I think we're going to lose the sense of really what a computer is, because it's going to be so integrated. It's almost like a motor. We use motors in hundreds of different ways. You come in contact with them during the day, but we don't think when we get in an elevator or when we use a pencil sharpener, I'm using motor technology now. So I think that the computer is essentially going to disappear in that sense.
Where are the interesting innovations taking shape now?
I think the most interesting ones are network related, related to the internet, to the World Wide Web. About a year ago, I wrote an open letter to Michael Spindler, the head of Apple, suggesting that he make all his computers run on the internet with a simple click of the mouse, and build that into it, make it the one way that anyone could get on the internet and do all the exciting things on it without having a very difficult setup process that you have when you try to do that now. And there were people at Apple who wanted this to happen, but what happened instead was they put their resources into Apple creating a more traditional online service because they felt that little piece would be a profit center. They really didn't have the big picture. And now, about a month ago, I read that Bill Gates wanted to do what I suggested for his system, and eventually we're going to see the next version of Microsoft Windows try to get onto the internet automatically and do that idea. So that's an opportunity lost for Apple.
So you think that this is the big innovation on the way, easier ways of getting onto the internet and using the internet?
You go to a computer show now, and it used to be everyone would say, well, what's the hot product? Is it a hot software product? Is it a hot hardware product? But now you look at it, and what's hot is people. Is what ways people could get connected with other people, what's called content, meaning, say, CD-ROMs or things where people, show their creativity in a way where it's easy to grasp. So I think that the industry has gotten mature to the point where, the real nuts and bolts aren't so much important as, people getting in contact with people or coming up with ideas to make other people think. And I think that's a great development.
Well, Stephen Levy, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Levy is a computer columnist for Newsweek and the author of a history of the Macintosh called Insanely Great. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about the Federal Reserve and interest rates. Also about Commerce Secretary Ron Brown. Republicans in the Congress continue to raise allegations about his personal finances. He denies impropriety, and the White House has said it supports him. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about the floods in Europe in this winter of 1995. But also back in 1953, when our now senior news analyst, Daniel Schorr, was in Holland, and he remembers the enormous floods of that year.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today's debates about economic and social conditions seem geared around the needs of the middle class. Commentator Gerald Early says it's time to examine some of our presumptions about the middle class.
Since the last election, there has been a great deal of talk about the disaffected American middle class. Yet in America, there are many middle classes, not just one. And while these various middle classes share several features and concerns, there are vital differences in their responses to the nature of middle class life. For instance, the black middle class, because of its history, has an ambivalent view of itself. Right after the Civil War, the black middle class was largely an aristocracy composed of more educated light-skinned or biracial blacks, those who had been artisans on plantations, and many who had been free before the war. This changed in the 1920s when the black middle class became a professional class made up of teachers, preachers, lawyers, doctors, and generally the college-educated. But the class was always a hodgepodge of the professional, the white collar, and the blue collar. Black postal clerks, police officers, office secretaries, auto workers, and retail sales clerks were considered middle class in the 1950s. There has been a big increase in the ranks of the professional black middle class in the last 20 years, in part because of affirmative action. I am one such person who became a middle class professional through this policy. But being black and middle class has always involved more than money. It is a state of mind. If the middle class generally feels frustrated and fearful about high taxes, bad schools, sex and violence in the media, and unresponsive government, the black middle class is even more overwhelmed by insecurity and powerlessness. They are a class that historically, because of racism, has never been able to function as a true elite, crippled as they were by white philanthropy, segregation, and color phobia. They are even more precarious economically than whites, as their middle class status is more threatened by economic downturns. Although catered to as consumers by a number of magazines, radio, and television shows, the black middle class lacks political leverage other than the race card and economic leverage other than its urge to consume. They are racked by identity problems for which Afrocentrism and hip-hop are proposed as the latest cures. They divorce at a high rate. They are stridently anti-intellectual and not as philanthropic as they should be. Not a single observation here is new. E. Franklin Frazier made them all and more besides in his famous 1957 book, The Black Bourgeoisie, that so stunned black folk at the time of its publication. Nonetheless, unlike many white members of the middle class, they have not turned against those below them, even though they are more distressed by the poor than most in the middle class, as they are more victimized by crime and pay larger property taxes. The black middle class still seeks human solidarity, indeed feels that solidarity is the most important expression of their blackness and their humanity. Perhaps they do not always practice this solidarity, yet they see their civic identity and fate as tied to the black poor, as perhaps free blacks saw their fate tied to their brothers and sisters in slavery. That our fate is tied to those below, and that there can be no good life for some without a good life for all, is an idea that we can never, as Americans, abandon. For it is that idea that will give the entire American middle class finally its purpose and its hope for the future.
Gerald Early is a professor of English at Washington University in St. Louis and author of the book The Culture of Bruising, which has been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award for criticism. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. Our program was directed by Alan Tu and Roberta Sharrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Why the Rich Get Richer, we talk about the economy and interest rates with journalist William Grider. And Fresh Air's prison correspondent Wilbert Rideau reports on an unprecedented dinner given by inmates of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, paying tribute to their departing warden. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.